Can I say welcome to all of you? Our agenda is not very long. We all have a copy of it in front of us. We have two items. We are going to consider the report of the public hearing, which I regard as being very important to us. We have said that after adopting the report, our aim finally is to debate the report in the House. And I think we still stand by that. We have a copy of the report in front of us. We all have it. Carl, do you have it? How would you want us to deal with this? A big document. Any suggestions?
Good morning, Chairperson and Honourable Members. There's two reports. The first report is the committee section report, which we all worked on together, that gives you detail as in each and every submission, what the issue was and what the recommendations were. The second report, which is 17 pages, is called the strategic report. That essentially would help both committees look at the direction forward. And what we thought would be helpful for this morning is between Crystal, Gary and myself, we will go through the essence of the report. So Crystal will go through the first issues around what the hearings were, the key issues that emerged. Then between Gary and myself, we will look at the recommendations. Gary will focus on all the legislative amendments and general recommendations, and I will look at recommendations in relation to oversight. So perhaps if we could deal with it in that way, focusing on the strategic report, what would be helpful from the honourable members would be any indication as to what you think we should highlight even more, what you think is missing, and then perhaps at the end, what we haven't included was, in terms of all the recommendations, what is it that the Portfolio Committee and Select Committee would take on for 2010. Even out of the list of 30, we can't possibly do 30. Maybe we can do 5 or 2, but what are those 2 or 3 things?
Okay. Members, the report was handed over to us sometime last week. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. Did we have an opportunity to go through it? As individual, we did.
And last year, Honourable Chairperson, we received this report too, because remember, we still gave input in doing the findings and recommendations. So I think, you know, it will be good the way, not Crystal, because she starts putting it, you know, where they go through it, and we just strengthen anything that we still want strengthened. And then also help, you know, in case there are recommendations that are left out. Thank you.
Okay. So we are familiar with the report. Crystal, where do we start?
Thank you, Chair. We'll start on page 1. I'm not going to go through the introduction and objectives so far. As Casper said, this is a summarized version, basically, of all the recommendations from the TIC report, and we also included the inputs made by members last year. So we'll start under point 2. I'm not going to read every line. I think if we just capture the general issue under each comment there. So under point 2, which is key issues identified in submissions. So what we've done there is we've looked at per department what are the key issues that have come out from the hearing and grouped them per department under the relevant government clusters. So the first section with the general ones is general issues that were raised throughout the 2 days of the public hearing. Page one. We'll start there, which is general. So the first thing there is that the committee acknowledges that gender-based violence disproportionately affects women and children. And also noting...
Hold on, Crystal, hold on. Okay. We understand which report we are dealing with. The smaller document.
The committee then also, we acknowledge then that yes, it affects women and children, but more so women and children in rural areas and those in impoverished environments who have less access to effective help. If we turn the page and we go over to page 2, also acknowledging that patriarchal attitudes and power dynamics are at the heart of domestic violence, and also that many victims don't know their rights, and where they do, they haven't been able to access the appropriate services in terms of domestic violence. The second key issue that came out, or cross-cutting issue that came out, was the lack of coordination. Several submissions noted that there's lots of emphasis on the criminal justice system, but not enough on violence prevention. So that is the key thing that needs to be looked at, instead of after trying to prevent the incidences. There's also no overarching framework or strategy to deal with domestic violence holistically. As we've noted, different departments have things that they're doing, but there's not a structured framework that guides exactly how to deal with domestic violence. And also in the same vein, that collaboration and communications between departments is not synergized. Like I just said, it's fragmented. Everyone's doing something, but there's nothing that speaks to one another. So there's no holistic vision of service intervention. Related to that also then is in terms of resources, that we noted from various submissions that there are inadequate resources available to deal with domestic violence. Departmental budgets don't take into account issues of gender, of children, of youth, of persons with disabilities. And that brings into question how these persons are prioritizing departmental budgets, especially also in relation to domestic violence. The next point, there is lack of reliable data. Again, departments are all doing something, but there isn't a database where we can access information on victims of domestic violence. And there's also no way to track whether the existing programs that are offered by departments to actually affect the lives of people. You can't go back and measure whether a program is really impacted on someone's life. There's also a thing about different departments each having their own information system, and there's no way to then collate that information because the systems don't match up with one another. And the last point is that, like I just said, there's no integrated information system to track trends in domestic violence and determine whether the targets set for reducing the incidences are being achieved. The committee also highlighted that the faith-based sector has a large role to play in terms of combating domestic violence, and that at some level it needs to be brought in, specifically because in many communities, your religious leaders are the first point of call. But also looking there that adequate services are provided there, because often people also go there and don't get the services they require. People are sent home and said, no, go and sort it out with your husband or whatever the case may be. If we move on to 2.2, if there's any questions or comments, please.
And before questions, do you want us to intervene after a little while, or do we go through the whole report? How do you want us to do it? Let's talk about that first, before.
Duncan, and then...
Thank you, Chairperson. Under general. I think then we're going to go over to the other, to the clusters. I would just like to make maybe a remark in on a point of not having to come back to the general statements and information that was just given to us.
Okay, before you make that,
thank you, Chair. I saw that for us to manage time efficiently. How is it where if we can go through all the reports, including general, and not make I mean some highlight, you know, where you want to raise, and then we do, you know, everything at the same time when we engage in comments, questions, and also including the general. Rather than ask, because I know that when you go general, we are going to overlap to some other issues under those clusters. So why don't we just leave the input to go through, so, and then we come back to comments.
Okay. Let's do it that way. You know, have the whole report and jot our little notes, and then we'll come back to it. Not unless, you know, there's a real, real burning issue, then you can intervene.
Chairperson, I think I agree. However, it is just something very small, but I also know that it will have a positive impact on the rest of it. I have asked, can I perhaps just...
Okay, let's hear you.
With regard to that, the resourcing and the lack of coordination, I have asked the department during the hearing that they will give us a breakdown of their budget, and we have not received any as such. So I just want to bring it under the attention of our researchers that is taken up. Because it is important when we get to do our budget speeches or speak about the domestic violence public hearing that we have those documents. Thank you.
First, while we are going through the report, let's note these budget issues. It's going to assist us in our budget debate. Let's not get there and raise things when we're in trouble with the budget.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not do that. So let's pick up these issues while we go along.
Okay, 2.2, the peace and security cluster, under which we have Department of Police and also Justice and Constitutional Development. If we first look at the Department of Police, there's various issues raised there, the first being non-compliance. From the submissions received, in some cases it appears that there's a disincentive by police to record incidents of domestic violence. So we know there are targets set for reducing crimes by 7 to 10% annually. And often when people come to report incidents of domestic violence, people are turned away or sent back and say, don't sort it out, so that those crimes are not captured, which also then looks as the figures are coming down. So often cases of common assault and rape and domestic violence are not adequately captured. In terms of firearms, they often are not being confiscated after being used to threaten victims, and the license of the alleged perpetrator is not suspended either. In terms of protection orders, the safety of persons who obtain these orders are often compromised in that police are often not willing to arrest perpetrators who have violated the protection order. Also, there have been reports of the behavior of police being demeaning and discriminatory when dealing with victims of domestic violence. Like we said earlier, discouraging women from taking action and thus subjecting the secondary victimization again. A particular case was in the case of farm women where they reported that they've come or wanting to make a case at the police, and they've been sent back saying, no, you're just drunk, farm women, go back and sort it out. So that's a serious issue that also needs to be looked at. And again, in terms of the reluctance of police officers to serve the protection order or to arrest perpetrators who have violated the protection order. Another key issue under that is risk assessment, and there's a need for that to be prioritized because how are victims being assessed when they arrive at the police station? How can I send someone back into that environment? So there's a definite need for risk assessment to be provided to make the safety of the victim a priority. The second point under the Department of Police is lack of resources. We know that in terms of the Act, there are certain things that the police have to do. But the excuse is we don't have resources, we don't have a vehicle to go out and go and meet with someone or go and assist someone. So that is also something that seriously needs to be looked at. Also in cases where victims have called and police have said it's not in our jurisdiction, call another police station. That's also something that needs to be looked at. We've spoken somewhat about protection orders, but particularly in terms of the purpose of the protection order, it's often not serving the purpose it's intended for, because people have a protection order, they have a piece of paper, but they still have to return to an abusive environment. So are they really getting the protection that they require? Also, in terms of cost implications, we've heard that in some cases where the sheriff charges 200 rand, in another one it's 500 rand, here it's 100 rand, those kinds of things. So in terms of cost implications for serving protection order, it's not applied uniformly across the country, so that's also something that needs to be looked at. And again, in terms of the reluctance of police officers to serve protection orders, there's a delay in serving the protection order, which also places the victim in grave danger. In terms of training, SAPS was here and they reported to us that they do provide training to police officials. The question is it adequate training? Once-off training is not something that's working, and we don't know whether people are being, we haven't looked at the modules. We don't know what's in those training modules. So are people being effectively equipped to deal with matters of domestic violence? So there's definitely a need to look at what training it is and at what level the training needs to be put at. And it's also highlighted that there's a need to often debrief police officials to keep them sensitive of the issues that they are dealing with. Because often it just becomes it's another case, and there's not the required sensitivity to deal with the issue of domestic violence. Specialized units were highlighted, and mostly presented at the public hearings welcomed the re-establishment of these specialized units to deal with victims of domestic violence, and those units are the Family Violence and Child Protection Unit and the Sexual Offences Unit. It was mentioned that these units would be reinstated, to put it that way, but there's no clarity as to when and how and where and those kinds of things. So there's more information needed to that. Also, in terms of if these units are re-established, in terms of their mandate in relation to domestic violence, in the past it's been very limited, so there's going to be a need to clarify what it is that these units will do in relation to domestic violence. In terms of victim empowerment, it was noted that in most police stations, there isn't facilities for private consultation when victims of domestic violence come to present their cases. There's a lack of trauma rooms, or there's not a nearby Tutuzela centre, which results in the victim having to stand there in public and provide a statement of a very traumatic experience, which was not conducive into the confidentiality or safety aspect. Also, often people working at those centres are lay counsellors and volunteers. We also don't know whether they have the adequate training to really be dealing with victims of domestic violence. It was also reported that there's often inadequate supervision of volunteers. So people are there, but there's no one supervising these volunteers to know exactly what's happening there. And also there's a high turnover. So you constantly have new faces, new people, you know, that kind of thing. One of the things that goes throughout when we speak about the victim empowerment program is that there appears to be a lack of interdepartmental collaboration with all departments responsible for victim empowerment. So social development must be doing something, health is doing something, police is doing something, but there's no synergy between the programs. And again, in terms of the attitude of police officials, the Batopele principles that we all have to ascribe to is not being enforced in police stations, which deters victims from laying a charge or seeking the protection order. In terms of record keeping, as we mentioned earlier, often in cases of domestic violence, police try to deter victims and send them back. So, as a result, also domestic violence registers aren't being kept in the way that they should, but also domestic violence is not a recognized reportable category of crime on its own, which leaves much scope for interpretation because people are coming to present their case, but it's captured under common assault, under those things, so it's lost somewhere. So there's a need for domestic violence to be recognized as a category of crime. Some of the submissions or the inputs also raise that there are community police forums, but what are they doing to deal with incidences of domestic violence? It was highlighted that often these forums are seen to be more politicized and not really working within their communities to deal with issues such as domestic violence. If we move on to the Department of Justice Constitutional Development, the first thing there was in terms of accessibility. We had one of the presenters that highlighted that in terms of persons with disabilities, sign language especially, and wheelchair accessibility, those kinds of things, it remains a problem at court. One of the examples was that often people have localized sign language where they live, but when they get to court, it's a different thing, so people are not able to communicate when they don't understand. Also in terms of hours of operation, are courts and officials really accessible after hours? There's a need in many areas for this because people are shift workers, people are casual employees, and they have to take time off work, which cuts into their wages. They don't have the luxury as you know, to go and sit at court day after day when the cases are being postponed. So there's a need for some of these services to really be available after hours so that people are able to access them. And with all these kinds of things, victims of domestic violence are often subject to secondary victimization, having to sit for long periods, having to spend the day there losing out on their wages, having to return the next day. All these issues impact on the victim. And also many court officials are ill-equipped to deal with matters of domestic violence. Similarly, as you mentioned, with police, there's training, but is it really adequate? And really there is that the availability of magistrates after hours is also problematic. We've spoken a lot about secondary victimization, particularly in terms of the delays in court processes. Also, there's cases where victims are not granted the protection order, but sent back to show with a notice to show cause, which means that this person has to return to that abusive environment to come back and show evidence to give them a protection order. So that in itself is subjecting the victim to secondary victimization. Also, as with in police stations where victims have to come and deliver come and present their case, often in court there's also a lack of privacy when dealing with domestic violence cases. It's a sensitive matter, but the court is usually open to everyone to come and attend. Specialization. There's a lack of a child-centered approach in matters related to court processes. We know that children are also victims of domestic violence, even if they haven't physically been abused, they witness these events, and where they have been the victim, there isn't a specific focus on them. Not enough is being done in terms of postponements of cases and long waiting periods that children have to sit at these courts, and also attitudes of court officials which can impact negatively on children. Coordination. Domestic violence is often interrelated with divorce and maintenance matters. So there's a combination of cases here, criminal and civil, but there's not sort of a one-stop shop where someone can go and have all these matters be dealt with. It's going from one place to another to deal with all these things. So many victims have been saying we have to go from pillar to post to sort all of this out, and it's costly for the victims. If we move on to 2.3 under the social services cluster, Department of Social Development, the first point there is psychosocial support. This was raised throughout that there is a serious lack of psychosocial support for victims of domestic violence. Most of the services being provided are from NGOs who are also battling to survive financially, and yet they still manage to render service. So what is it that needs to be done for government to provide adequate psychosocial support to victims? Interventions that are rendered are usually purely from a biomedical perspective, as opposed to a developmental community-based approach that includes psychosocial rehabilitation. And often where medical intervention is provided, so when someone goes to hospital to be seen to, there's very little or no follow-through for the victim. So whoever's on hand to deal with the person will take down the statement or fill in the J88, but there's no follow-through as to what happens to this person after they leave the hospital. Again, there's insufficient attention to ensuring the safety of children, as well as addressing their specific needs or their specific psychosocial needs which arise from them witnessing domestic violence. Also, it was highlighted that services aren't reaching children. Instead of social workers coming to the children's homes, often children have to go to the offices, which is not acceptable, and it impedes access to the service. And in many cases where services are provided, it's only provided to that specific victim, not to the other people in that household, be it a child, a grandparent, another family member that's also been witness to the violence. And like we said, the extent and range of psychosocial services offered is limited. For example, there's very few support groups for victims of domestic violence. One of the very key issues that was raised was in terms of shelters. There's a severe shortage, especially in rural areas. And it wasn't clear from any of the inputs that were made. Did the Department of Human Settlement send us anything? They didn't respond, so it's not clear what's being done. I mean, it's under social development, but still, we haven't had response. Social development said they are rolling out to increase the number of shelters, but by when, where, those kinds of details are lacking. And also there's a limited access to emergency shelters for victims of domestic violence, which requires urgent attention. Again, poor coordination, there's a lack of synergy between the different programs within the Department of Social Development. Again, lots of things are happening in the department, but there's no collaboration in terms of how these things are happening. In terms of social security, it was highlighted that in many instances, persons with severe mental illness struggle to access disability grants, and that SASA must ensure that measures are put into place to make these services accessible to all persons. Again, looking at the victim empowerment program in terms of social development, the program in itself is a good program, but it's failed many victims, largely to a lack of inadequate resource allocation, as well as the minimum standards of service delivery and victim empowerment not being met. There's also a lack of guidelines for the victim empowerment program, which severely impedes service delivery. A lack of human resources. We know that there is a limited number of social workers and they have incredibly high caseloads. But there seems to be an over-reliance on social workers alone, as opposed to having a holistic multidisciplinary team dealing with various aspects. It's not clear that apart from social workers, who else is involved in any services to victims of domestic violence. If we move then on to the Department of Health, one of the key things that came out there was that in terms of forensic specialists, there's a severe shortage, and that directly impacts on the ability to provide medical legal services to victims of domestic violence. As mentioned earlier, there appears to be little or no follow-up of victims of domestic violence once they have visited a health facility. Also, healthcare professionals have been reported to subject victims of domestic violence to secondary victimization and aren't held to account for this. It's also been highlighted that in many instances, healthcare professionals don't know about the Domestic Violence Act, which speaks to what their role is and how they play a part in assisting the victim. So there is definitely a need for holistic care provisions to victims of domestic violence, particularly in relation to psychosocial trauma. Looking at the Department of Human Settlements, in a couple of cases people raised the issues that they'd been married in community of property, obviously, and the family been provided RDP housing. Once the victim left or had separated or divorced, they often were not able to access housing again because according to government registers or so, it indicated that they'd already benefited from housing. So it must be noted that the marital status of a domestic violence victim or survivor should not hinder access to government services such as housing. There's also an urgent need to respond to secondary housing for victims of domestic violence. As we heard throughout the hearings, also people go to shelters. What happens after the shelter? There is not enough secondary housing for people when they exit their shelters. There's also related to that, there's no policy that makes provision for people who exit shelters to access secondary housing. If we move on to the governance cluster, which deals directly with the Department of Women, Children and Persons with Disabilities, presenters highlighted that there isn't an overarching national strategic policy framework to deal with domestic violence. So there's a lack of synergy between what departments are doing. So the department, which is new and being placed with ease in looking at these socially vulnerable groups, could play a key role, particularly since they're responsible for the needs of socially vulnerable groups. So it's well placed to lead the development of an overarching policy framework to address domestic violence. In addition, the department has outlined specific programs to address high levels of violence against women, children, and persons with disabilities, and ensure that these programs are adequately costed and resourced, because that is one of the key problems with a lot of programs and policies that have been put out. It's there, but they have not been costed and resourced, which leads them to fail. The department has also worked collaboratively with other departments to ensure the implementation of the Domestic Violence Act, and ensure the inclusion of organizations addressing domestic violence in the planning of a national policy, national strategic policy framework. The National Planning Commission and Monitoring and Evaluation, as the primary bodies responsible for planning, monitoring, and evaluation, it's imperative that these two bodies are included in the development of a strategic framework to deal with domestic violence. Monitoring and evaluation is important for oversight in terms of implementation of the DVA, as well as holding service providers to account for the effective implementation of the DVA. So that covers all the general issues that were raised throughout the 2 days.
Members, can we then deal with that, what has been presented, before we go to the recommendation? But Crystal, I thought perhaps you would also mention something about the Gender Commission and its role, which they are not actually doing. They should be having a great, you know, role or some participation in the whole issue of the DVA, but they don't seem to be.
We've included something under the recommendations in the CGEP that if you'd like, we can highlight that they are not fulfilling that role as well. We can put something in along that line. But there is a recommendation in terms of the CGEP.
Members? Can we open up for discussion on the report? I think it's very good work that has been done. Mm-hmm. Very good report. You really used your skills. Thanks for that. Could we have a discussion on the report? But also I wanted to check whether did you send copies of the report to the people we had invited, especially the NGOs that are also dealing with some of these issues?
Chairperson, we did engage with some people, but what we thought is once there's an adoption year today, we can send out and then with Nelisa look at a thank you letter for acknowledging the time and effort that people have taken in organizations to come to the committees and hearings. And then in that report, all people would have an indication as to what the committees have decided that they would take on, and particularly around a debate in the House. So I think after today, we'll amend accordingly, and then between Elisa and ourselves, we'll send it off to all the people who have sent us submissions.
Could we have one, two, three hands up?
Thank you, Chair, and apologies for being late. I'm really sorry that I got caught up in issues in the community that involve things just like this. And I just want to say thank you for the report. I see in writing what I have been experiencing in practice in the communities. So I'm really glad that we've got something like this that we can work from. And I just want to say now, I think this is a challenge for us as a committee, that we can be seen to put into practice measures that are actually going to work so that our legislation and the institutions that we have available, which are clearly quite inadequate, can be beefed up. So I think this is a tremendous challenge for us as a committee, and let's work together on this and making a difference in the lives of so many. So just a general comment. Thank you.
Duncan?
Thank you, Chairperson. Also, thank you to the research team. I'm always very proud of them. Chairperson, my first comment is the main overall concern for me is the fact that the Act itself has not been processed. And I think that should be, we should actually start from there. The Domestic Violence Act has not been processed. And that is why it's been so poorly implemented. And I think that should actually be our main concern. I just wanted to know.
Thanks, Chairperson. And thanks to the compilers of the report. A lot has been covered in the report. And a lot have been covered in the public hearings. I have been part on some of them. The report, as it reflects to domestic violence, and I'm not sure, maybe I'll still have to go through the Act to look at whether these areas are also taken care of. It appears we seem to look at domestic violence only as meaning the fight between husband and wife, which would therefore impact on the children one way or the other. And in my view, that domestic violence includes that, but it's not the only thing. There is more than that involved in domestic violence. Which I think we need to look at and make sure that the Act takes care of. The second thing I want to look at is that we now have a ministry.
Sorry. Just before you go on, just say more to what you have just said on the issue of domestic violence not being between men and women. Just say a bit more on that.
Okay, domestic violence impacts very much negatively on people with disability. A lot of these people, and they raise it in their presentations all the time, that the first violence that happens against them is that immediately on the basis of their disability, they are regarded as secondary human beings, not as a real human being. And resulting from the treatment that they get in the families they live in has got a lot of either emotional or physical violence that happens to them. Example would be given around people who are blind, around pensioners, because as I say, in my view, a pensioner is a person with disability. Pensioners, you know, most of the time they would go the poor old ladies and old timers to get their pension, just for that pension money to become a conflict issue at home when they arrive. Children wanting to take this money and using it for other things of their own benefits, and that would create domestic violence. I'm just quoting one or two examples. And some other time, the same thing happens to people, say, that are having other disabilities as well. For example, blind people are also entitled to see the same benefit. And obviously, after they have received that, they get robbed of it one way or the other, either by children or by their wives or by their husbands or by whoever. And that, to me, is tantamount to domestic violence, because as soon as this person reacts to that, it creates a conflict which might result in violence. And that is even worse, because, say, I'm blind. I cannot even see you ready to fight with you. You know, you see me, but I can't see you. If I want to hit you, then I'll hit and miss, because I'll go next to where I heard your voice speaking. So those kinds of violences, one way or the other, I might not be an expert to know how to coin an inclusive kind of a clause in the Act, but I should think when we discuss, we should look at issues not generally only between husbands and wives, but inclusive of other vulnerable groups as well. And that was going to be included in my second part, the issue of the people with disability.
Actually, all of what you have said does not appear in the Act. So that is one of the gaps in the Act. Mm-hmm. Maybe so.
Well, I say maybe because I cannot speak with confidence. I have not looked at the Act myself in that area.
You must look at the Act. It doesn't say anything about the groups you said. You know, the issue of the pensioners, the issue of the blind, and so forth.
Thanks a lot, Chairperson. Chairperson, while the previous speaker was speaking, you know, when it comes to the disabled, I'd like to make another example that first can put in, because I think I spoke about it in this meeting, where a person that's deaf and dumb, a woman, you know, being attacked by her husband, but she can't scream now. And therefore, I think, you know, when it comes to persons with disability, we have to look at what reasonable accommodation, as they do in the workplace, could a person perhaps put into the Act. But I'd like to thank Crystal, the researchers, actually, for highlighting, you know, when it comes to domestic violence, it's not criminalized. It's regarded just as ordinary assault. And I think those are issues that we have to push, that it should be criminalized as a crime, domestic violence itself. And then when it comes to the firearms, I remember the police, I just hope it's in our recommendations, said that the Act has to be changed. Because look here, when something happens, we brought up many examples, you know, where the police do not confiscate that arm, that firearm. And we know that when women are in such situations, even with the interdict, they can die. And then the last thing that I'd like to speak to, The Honourable Member Duncan reminded us about the budget. But we also have to look at the disaggregated data within the department, because we have to build up our database. Because if something happens, like I spoke to you about the SONA report of the president, we gave the unemployment rate of 500,000. Yes. We must know how many women are included there. Even the, I think, the 900 jobs that were lost. Because in the previous regime, women were retrenched first. Is it still the case? Is there impact of our policies on what is happening in our new regime? That's all that I would like to contribute. Thank you.
Is that all? Any more here? And just on the issue that you have raised, on the issue of the deaf and dumb person, sometimes you could ask yourself, right here in Parliament, are there such measures for people like that? Right here where we are in Parliament. In case of a fire, we run down the steps. What do they do? In Parliament, where we make these laws, are there such precautions in place? Honourable Member, you had your hand up.
Look, Chair, I had my hand up, and thank you. I think, first of all, we appreciate the report and the matters raised by the researcher here. We have heard the hearing, we have gone through that process. We know what is at stake, and we know what are the problems affecting people with disability. And we have then read the report. It does appear that there is some recommendation made, and I would assume that that recommendation must have been referred to some structure. It would be appropriate, as far as I'm concerned, that one would like to hear what the response is of concerning the recommendation, so that probably we could now then, on the basis of the response from where recommendations will be sent, we can then see what can then be the way forward. Thank you.
Honourable Duncan.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to add something else. I've also asked which department is actually leading, where it's a lead on this particular act. And if I remember correctly, they said it's the Department of Justice. And if members can remember, Chairperson, that Dr. Nat, I can't pronounce it, from the Health Department, was very, if he could make a choice, then he would say that the Department of Health should actually be the lead department. I would want to ask whether we as a committee can perhaps take that on and ensure that the fact that it is with justice, is it where it belongs, or must we perhaps look at other options and whether we can actually influence that process. Thank you.
Is the act in the right place? Is it located in the right place in the first place?
Yeah,
I'm sure we could even talk about that. I don't think anything stops us from doing that. Sometimes you have doubts. Why with justice? Why not with the police? Or why not with social development? Why not with health and so forth?
Thank you, Chair. I think this is the opportunity we have for our committee to take up these issues. Yes, we have a problem. It is located in the Department of Justice, but they are cross-cutting issues. And our whole portfolio is so cross-cutting that this is our challenge, and this is where we can be seen to be making a mark. So I think all these issues are the ones that we must drive and make sure that those deficiencies are covered.
Is there also a problem with legislation like this? It does give us a bit of a problem because justice will always shift to the police will always shift to social development and so forth. The one will shift to health, so we need to be clear who is actually supposed to be taking the lead on this. Honorable Kiki, do you want to say something? Honorable Labanya? I'm challenging you for that.
Challenging us. Thank you very much. I want to thank the researchers. You've been always doing the good work. I know you. I think it's going to take a very long time if we are going to challenge if the act is replaced. Is placed in the right within the right department. It's going to take a long time. But now I thought the whole objective of having the hearings is to look at the gaps so that you are able to say, to propose an amendment to the act, not a change to the department. Otherwise, if we are going to have that approach, it's going to take another 5 years to do so. So I want to suggest that these are the recommendations. There are recommendations that came out of here, and let us look on those recommendations, because ours is to seriously work with the Department of Justice, work together with the Portfolio Committee, and make a proposal that where we could make an amendment to the Act, because it is not, the implementation is very poor, and there's a cry out there. We had hearings, and this is what came out of the hearings. So what I want to propose, rather than looking at the right place or not, is the amendment to the act.
But I'm sure we could raise it. I mean, nothing stops us from raising it, because also, is that fair for us to live with this consciousness? Is this thing in the right place or not? But I take your point that it could take longer, but we could raise it, you know, just to make them aware that we suspect that it's not in the right place, you know. Because we shouldn't always have this at the back of our mind, that is it in the right place or not. But I take your point that it could take longer.
Thanks, Chair. You know, the interesting part about this will be the budget. You know, they say function, money must follow the function, allocation of function. There are certain things that you could put probably quite an accurate figure to money-wise, like shelters for abused persons, women, that you could probably quantify. But certain other things, as is rightly said, it goes over various departments. So obviously the act will have to, should be implemented, for argument's sake, by the police service as such. And probably for whatever reason they haven't received sufficient training, or maybe they're not implementing all aspects, also like Department of Justice. But then, you know, the money is budgeted there already. So it's a question of training and, you know, to have ensure that the act there is implemented properly. But other things, you know, there will have to be some sort of costing done, you know, if this has to be implemented properly. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me firstly say well done to the researchers. And mine is just a comment. You know, looking at this report, I think for our community, it's a small Bible for us. We have almost everything here, even in the rural, even in the provinces. But when it comes to domestic violence, as one of the honorable members has said now, it's so vast that domestic violence involves the whole family, like sons fighting mothers, daughters stabbing brothers, you know,
it's so vast. And the most thing that really worries me is our committee involves each and every department. And we are going to have a problem in pinpointing which department to say you are responsible for this and the other. Like when it comes to costing, I've been asking myself questions, whose department is it? It's almost every department. So it shows how vast our questions are going to be when we go in. The mandate that we are going to have, it involves almost every department. So we have many questions than answers, Jay. And it depends on us how to start, where to start, and what to do. I think here we have researchers that do help us, but the most thing lies on us committee members, so just to put our heads together and see how far can we deal with it. Thank you.
That's also what is going to assist us is to carefully listen today what the minister has for this department.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether, after listening, if we are not satisfied, we'll check what other avenues we have to influence that.
Mm-hmm.
So I am looking forward to hear what the minister has in place for this department. I think that will also guide us to tell us how serious we are about this new department. We'll hear the budgets, will tell us, will guide us.
Thank you, Chairperson, and let me also join my colleagues in the report that has been presented by the researchers and put together. Thank you very much. I think like the other member said, I think this is going to be our tool.
Mm.
It's going to be our tool that we are going to use to actually monitor departments. But then also saying that if you look at the report on page 9 under recommendations, 3.2, I think it has been highlighted that, you know, that the imperative that...
Are you there already?
On page 9, under recommendations, I think they have highlighted the fact that, you know, this has to be costed out. And
mm-hmm.
as you are saying that, you know, today we must listen carefully. And also using what Comrade Malfat was saying to say, we have to disaggregate, you know, these according to the cost. And I think the other fortunate part with this portfolio committee is that it is a monitoring and evaluation committee at the highest level, so that our ministry, the Women's Ministry, has got an influence at that level. So we need to assist her in making a follow-up, in monitoring at this level, so that she can also make an impact there. I understand that you are saying maybe we should explore some other avenues. But I think funds within each and every, you know, department can be shifted. If we feel strongly that this has not been budgeted for, I mean, gone are the times whereby domestic violence was not budgeted for. It has not been budgeted for many, many years. But I think with our involvement in here, we have to use our influence so as to, you know, ensure that this is implemented. Thank you.
Also, what I wanted to check with the researchers You would remember that in the hearings, the NGOs made lots of contributions while they were there. I just wanted to check. That's why I was asking you before whether you have sent a copy to them. But also I would have expected you to have to send a draft copy. Because I'm just asking myself, how would they then make their additions to the report? Or do we expect them to make additions after today? How is it going to be done? But I strongly feel we should have given them a chance to make whatever recommendations they had in addition.
So just to respond to that, we did engage, we couldn't obviously engage with all the NGOs, but we selected a key few NGOs. For example, Lisa Vetten, I mean, she came to present to us, and I mean, they did a range of research. We liaised with the children's sector and then with the disability sector, and we went through each and every recommendation. And I mean, between my Joy was included and our other researcher, we cross-checked each and every recommendation to make sure that nothing was left out. Mm-hmm. So what is in this report literally covers everything. It may just have been reworded and reformulated, mm-hmm. but it essentially it covers everything. And at the end of the day, we acknowledge that many people have given inputs and recommendations, but this report here is for members to say, we acknowledge that these are the recommendations that have come through, but strategically, for what we can manage in 2010 in the next 5 years, this is what we've decided is what we will monitor, feed through, and take forward. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe that's the slight difference into having to do everything that we were told versus what realistically we can do within this given time.
That we, you know, we engage them and give them an opportunity. Otherwise, it shouldn't look futile. Why do they waste their time and come before us? You know, there shouldn't be those type of feelings. I think Marcus, you had a hand up. Do they participate in proceedings like this? They don't. They don't, ne? I'm sure the rules don't allow us, unless you are invited, like we have invited you to the public hearing. That's where you get a floor to do them. But otherwise, in proceedings like this, you are not allowed. I'm sure you should check the rules, you know, that govern the proceedings, and perhaps after the meeting you can. Yeah, okay. Duncan? Let's try and move fast so we can move on to the recommendations.
Thank you, Chairperson. In light of what you have said, that we must listen carefully this afternoon, how much will be in our budget, I just want to re-emphasize, Chairperson, that right from the beginning we said that we are the committee with teeth and that we are going to fight. And I think that we as a committee on these sectors are the hope for our people outside there. Yeah. So I feel that we need to be positive and not be, you know, not try and say that, you know, it's not going to work, it's going to take long. We have to make impact. And we have to make impact right from the start. When we go do our speeches out there on this public hearing, the people must hear our voices. Mm-hmm. And in this committee, also, Chairperson, we said that here we're not going to have politics keep us away from uniting behind the people out there. When we come into Parliament, that is where we can, you know, use our party political affiliations. So my request is once again, let's tackle each and everything that we heard today, what we can add and even strengthen. We must use. So ending off by saying after you have said we must listen this afternoon, I again say that I do request from all the departments, to give us the breakdown so that when we hear this afternoon how much our budget is, then at least we have the department's budgets to tell us what are they doing, how much are they budgeting for women, how much are they budgeting for children, how much are they budgeting for the disabled, and also for the youth. So that is my honest recommendation. Thanks.
So it's important that we listen carefully in that budget speech, so that just after what you have said, if the budget allocated for this ministry is not adequate, we should be able to hear from the other departments whether they have accommodated us. You understand? Then that will satisfy us. If our budget is not very good, then we should hear the police saying, well, so much is budgeted, justice should be saying, education should be saying, we've got so much for kids and all of that. Yeah, let's listen carefully and hear.
Chairperson, I was going to suggest that because as we talk, we're already making recommendations. And we're already touching on some of the things here unaware. Why are we not giving them an opportunity to present this and as we talk? Because what you've just said is recommendations. What I said were recommendations. What she said, she said earlier was recommendations, and they are recommendations in paper. Why don't we allow them to present and then we talk to each already?
Well, it's always the case with these members. We just get carried away. Okay, can I give you the opportunity then to move on?
Chief, just one last thing. I don't want to lose the point about where is the act located, is it in the right place? And I mean, I take on all Kiki's concern about how long it will take. Yes, we can raise it, but if we look at lessons learned around the Children's Act, they also had to deal with several departments. And if you look at the National Youth Development Agency Act, it's again several departments. And I think the lessons learned out of those two acts is they put in a particular clause that compels departments to work together. So it's something about an integrated policy framework. That isn't in the act. So in terms of the legislative amendment that Gary will talk to now, that's missing. That can clearly be a recommendation, which is, and I mean, even working together costs money. So that, in terms of where it's located, maybe the one way around as to moving it from justice is to say we need something that forces people to work together that must be done. Because at the moment that isn't there. So that's the other way around we can capture to ensure that the resourcing of allocation happens.
That's why we talk now, we hear that. Because we have engaged in talking. Okay, then can you move on to recommendation?
Thank you, Chairperson. Before I begin, I would just like to acknowledge the Women's Legal Center. They were not included in the acknowledgements in the report, in the bigger, bulkier report completed by the committee section. They did make quite a substantial input into the public hearings, and I just wanted to acknowledge them before we start. Secondly, then, in terms of the recommendations, I'll be dealing with. Chairperson. In terms, of, I'll be dealing with the legislative recommendations. And before I begin, it's a little bit difficult. This is a little bit tricky because it's divided into two sections. First, it is in terms of specific sections of an act, and then the more tricky part would be the regulations to specific pieces of legislation. Now, the regulations fall under the exclusive jurisdiction of the minister concerned for a particular act. And the only way we can, or the committee can have oversight over that regulation is in the exercise of the oversight of the particular minister and the performance of that minister. So that is the distinction before we begin, that there's legislation and the sections are pieces of act. And then there's a regulations which the committee can then exercise the oversight in terms of the performance of the minister before we begin.
Okay.
Then, in terms of the amendments to the Domestic Violence Act, one of the major problems and gaps that have been highlighted was the discretionary powers of the police and how they view and interpret certain sections of the Domestic Violence Act. That is a very big problem. One of the major concerns was Section 8 of the Domestic Violence Act, which highlights the issue of imminent harm. How does the police interpret, or how do police officials interpret issues of imminent harm? It's in their discretion when the person needs to be arrested. Following that, is imminent harm verbal abuse? Is imminent harm physical abuse? Is it rape? Is it murder? What is imminent harm? So the committee will then have to decide, do we tackle the issue of imminent harm in terms of a specific legislative amendment and say, we define imminent harm as ABC, or do we then say, should there be a regulation or a set of guidelines that we will establish, or the Department of Police establishes, to say to the police official, this is what imminent harm is. If you believe these criteria or these situations are there, then you must arrest. So that is the first thing. It's the discretionary powers of the police and how we deal, and how the committee and then the department deals with that. Second, to in terms of legislative amendments, is the issue of domestic partnerships. Civil society highlighted one of the biggest problems is that women who cohabit with their partners do not access access the protection orders as much as women who are in marriages. The reason for this is they fear, there is a definite fear of reprisal from the intimate partner after she gets the interim or the final protection order. There's a fear that she might lose the house or the property or the belongings that she has in that home, that she might lose that after there is a protection order. So there is a need to look at the finalization of domestic partnership legislation. Finally, as all the members have highlighted before, is the costing of the Domestic Violence Act. If there was no costing of the Domestic Violence Act at the beginning, it is critical that we do that now so that we can cost the amendments to the Domestic Violence Act, because it's pointless we do, there's no costing of the actual act, and then we come afterwards, oh, let's cost the amendments if we do not know what's happening at the beginning. Then secondly, in terms of the general recommendations, this is where the regulations come in. This is the trickier part, because now we have to look at the performance of the minister in relation to the bodies or the officials that are under his or her control. Firstly, I would like to highlight that the regulations are not under the legislative influence of this committee directly. It needs to be handled through the performance of the minister. We can bring the minister and say, what is the minister doing in terms of the other regulations and how he deals with his officials. So that is the way we can get around that. And he needs to hold his officials to account, because this committee holds him to account. What is he doing, or what is she doing in that specific department? One of the major issues that was highlighted by civil society during the public hearings was the issue of firearms control. One of the first issues was the review of the training received by police officials in terms of the Domestic Violence Act and then the Firearms Control Act. There's a need for improved training by police officials that do not comply, that do not know that they are not complying, and they do not know how to comply with the National Instruction on Domestic Violence and the Firearms Control Act. That then goes into specific issues of the seizure of firearms when there are protection orders. It is essential that police question witnesses when they do go to the home of the complainant in the domestic violence cases, that they question witnesses and people who are at the scene and say, was there a firearm used in this specific instance? They should not wait until the matter goes to a hearing at the magistrate's court before there are issues of seizure of firearms raised. That is too late, because the person could have already, once again, if you go to the legislative amendments, the issue of imminent harm. That person has already suffered that harm. It's too late to wait until the person goes to the court to then discover, oh, there's a firearm. It's too late already. So the police definitely then have to be trained around the seizure of the firearm. then one of the major issues is, like I've mentioned now, is the gap between the interim protection order and then the final protection order. There's a big gap in terms of the seizure of weapons. It's too late, like I said, it's too late for the police to have only seized the weapon once the final protection order has been granted, because there's the time between the first complaint, the lodging of the interim protection order, and the initial questioning. Once that order has been granted, there's a timeline for a return date, and then only then does the magistrate question around issues of, is there a firearm involved, especially in terms of issues where there are policemen, where policemen are the respondents in domestic violence cases. So the specific recommendations there is then to introduce more rigorous questioning relating to the presence of weapons in the communal home, not just firearms, knives. Recently, the issue of the crossbow, what weapons are present, are there any weapons in the home, does the person or does the respondent have access to weapons, are the weapons not just in the home but in the workplace, does that person have access to weapons there? Secondly, this is critical, the transfer of the onus to remove firearms from the communal home away from the applicant and to the presiding officer. Because usually it is the duty of the applicant of the protection order to come and say, my husband or my partner has a gun at home. So the presiding officer especially in the cases of interim protection orders where it's urgent and the presiding officer comes to the police station, that presiding officer has to instantly ask, is there a weapon? Have you been harmed by a weapon? And question around issues of that. Finally, then also around the discretionary powers of the police, they must make it clear, the presiding officer should make it clear that the firearm must be removed immediately and not wait. That is absolutely critical, and not wait for the return date once the order is made final. Then in terms of the independent complaint services, like I said, the regulations and the subsidiary bodies of the individual departments, is to look at the oversight of the independent complaints directorate over the South African Police Service, because the independent complaints directorate is tasked with reviewing the allegations of abuse of police power, particularly insofar as they relate to domestic violence. The South African Police Service Act does not afford the independent complaints directorate with sufficient powers to hold the police to account. They will make recommendations and say, these are the situations where you have not followed up, where there was abuse of police power, but the ICD is powerless to compel the police service to actually follow up on those allegations and on those recommendations. So, presently there are discussions involved to move certain sections that relate to the Domestic Violence Act and the discretionary and the powers that the ICD has over the police service to actually move that completely over to SAPS. And in that regard, it is critical, and that's the first issue. The second issue is there are moves also to increase the powers of the Independent Complaints Directorate, and such amendments should be coming to Parliament in this year. That is up for discussion. However, it is critical that this committee then form part of those discussions and confer with the Committee on Police to say, these are the issues that are at hand. We noticed that the Independent Complaints Directorate does not have sufficient oversight capabilities over the police, and the police disregard what the ICD says. It is critical that in terms of domestic violence, the ICD can follow up and say, you guys are not doing your job. In terms of the performance monitoring framework then for courts, one of the biggest issues highlighted during the domestic violence public hearings was the record keeping at court that is poor. There is no uniform record keeping between courts, between different districts, and even in the actual court. So the clerks who issued the protection orders have no idea what the clerk of the court is doing. So if there's a charge that now comes to court from a woman who has suffered domestic violence, and there is a interim protection order being sorted out by the clerk, the two do not know what is happening. There should be some sort of record which says, oh, there is Ms. X, Y, and Z who has now come to court. There is the interim protection order. Let's put this charge together with that protection order to strengthen her case against the respondent. That is critical. Then, it is important that a performance marching framework then get established by the committee, or we can bring the minister in and say these are the recommendations by the committee that there should be a performance marching framework, and this will enable then the authorities, which would be the minister, the DG, to then look at how to assess the quality and the completeness of record keeping by the court, the standardization of the process across courts and in courts as well, the working hours. If there are we've all heard about the long queues that are present at the domestic violence offices at the courts. So then, how we can speed up those processes, and then also to make it mandatory that all domestic violence protection orders get dealt with in private offices and not public, so everyone can hear what the particular problem of that applicant might be. Second to last would be the service of protection order, and the main issue here was the servicing of the protection orders on the respondent by the police. There's an over-reliance by office by the magistrate to actually serve those protection orders using the police service, and we know what the big problems there are. The police officers do not see it as an urgent matter, so what they'll do is they'll roll it over to the next shift. And when the next shift comes in, they'll say, but this is not my job. I'm not going to do it. I'll do it when I have free time. In that free time, a woman could have been killed. That is completely unacceptable. So then it is what we're saying is there needs to be a reworking of the Regulation 15 of the Domestic Violence Act to look at how the court officials or the magistrates can make more use of the sheriff to serve protection orders, because they have the know-how. They know exactly how to trace people, they know where to go, and it's not just, I don't like doing this. They're actually obliged because that is their job. Then as sheriff, they need to go and serve those protection orders. And then secondly, once these recommendations are made in terms of Regulation 13 of the Domestic Violence Act, the Minister of Justice is responsible for sheriffs and for the magistrate. That minister should then bring those regulation to this committee and say, this is how I'm going to change it. I'm going to make regulations and a sort of instruction manual for the magistrates and say, this is how you do it. This is how you say, let's use the sheriff instead of using the police officers. Secondly, also, this is also mentioned by the members, is the cost of serving protection orders severely hampers women from applying for protection orders. That is completely unacceptable. What should be done is, particularly in rural areas, these women do not have money to have protection orders served on respondents. So in that case, it is critical that the regulations must then be put in place to make explicit reference to court that they should then pay for protection orders where the applicant cannot afford to have that protection order served on the respondent. Also, then I remember one of the members made reference to persons with disabilities. One of the issues also was, how do persons with disabilities then understand what's in the protection order? Because they might be blind and they might be unable to read. There needs to be a specific emphasis made on the protection orders for persons with disabilities, particularly in cases where the person or the respondent or the claimant or both have visual impairments. Should we then look at protection orders in Braille? Should we have the sheriff then say, this is what's in the protection order, because there are specific sections in the protection order that says the respondent should not do A, B, C, D, E. The respondent may not remove property from the communal house or beaches, the claimants, etc., etc. So how do we look at persons with disabilities in terms of servicing the service of protection orders? And then finally, it is the ensuring the availability of shelter and counseling services. Now, that was one of the major problems highlighted or gaps highlighted by during the public hearings. And it was noted that the Domestic Violence Act does not place any corresponding obligations on health and social service providers to make such services available. Once again, there were questions raised of who takes charge of the Domestic Violence Act? Is it justice? Is it health? Can it be better served under health where this gap is? There's no access to shelter. There are no access, access to counseling services. Would it better be served then if if this act is put under the discretion of the Minister of Health or the Minister of Social Development? So those are the questions that need to be answered as well by the committee in taking this the situation forward. Also, what is also problematic is that because there is this gap, there seems to be this sort of attempt to deal with it in a general manner. Section 19 of the Domestic Violence Act says that the minister may make regulations on any other matter that she or he deems necessary or expedient in terms of to achieve the object of the act. The act doesn't mention anything about shelter, or the act doesn't mention anything about counseling services. So this is an attempt to bridge that divide. It's too general, and that's unacceptable. In this regard, then, the Department of Social Development should be consulted to come up with guidelines to determine to make access to shelters and counseling services available to victims of domestic violence. It is critical then that once this recommendation is made, that the committee then takes part in the development of those guidelines and actually take ownership of it and look at issues of how counseling services, in terms of costing now, how counseling services and shelters will be funded. We know there are the Tutuzela centers which are funded by private consortiums and by external funders. How will this be funded? The act needs to be costed to look specifically at that as well. Then in terms of these shelters and counseling services, the training for those service providers to have a uniform norms and standards that are available when and as they provide services, and having competent staff available to provide those services. And then also the management and recruitment of volunteers, where, because we know, it was one of the matters that was raised, that civil society have these professionals available to provide those services. Civil society can do it. How can we rope them in to be part and take ownership of this process? And then finally, the nature of the interventions required in terms of to address domestic violence. It is critical then that once the committee looks at those issues and coming up with guidelines for counseling and shelter services, that the committee then makes note of the relationship between child abuse and intimate partner abuse. It's critical that in situations where there are children, how can we then help the children as well who also suffer as a result of domestic violence? And then as well, the Department of Health also has a role to play in this regard in terms of rendering, in terms of providing services by well-trained professionals. Finally, again, there have been a list of recommendations made in terms of the regulations to various acts. And just to bring it all together, it is important that when those regulations get made by the minister, because the committee doesn't have a direct oversight role in terms of those regulations, that when those regulations get made or the recommendations be sent to the department, that the committee look at bringing in those ministers under whose jurisdiction these recommendations fall and say, how are those regulations being developed? How can we be part of it? And the committee actually has an oversight and bring the minister a cut and say, what are you doing? And do those regulations fit the needs of women? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Could we talk to the recommendations a bit? We have already started doing that, but could we say something to the recommendations? Honorable Lebanya.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, colleagues. Firstly, I would also want to add to what my colleagues have already said, to thank the researchers for putting together the report. Chairperson, when looking at the recommendations, I'm just sitting here thinking about the possibility of also thinking about the issue of educating our communities, because I think that is a very crucial part which is most of the time not attended to, whereby you have got these very good acts, but our people down there don't know about them. What is it that we can do to ensure that there is a program that is aimed at actually driving an awareness campaign to ensure that communities are made aware of this? Because most of the problems, for example, you'll find that the partner is afraid to go and report domestic violence just because she or he doesn't understand that what are my rights if I go and report, what is it that I'm entitled to, and all those things. So I think we should also think about that and how we can best position it in this document. The second issue is the issue of user-friendly police stations. You have got, we have said it many times here in this report, the issue of training of police men and women and all that. But to me, that is not enough unless you've got user-friendly police stations, because automatically if you go into a police station and then you find that you have got to report your problem, which is so sensitive, in front of everybody else, then that might actually make you not to be open enough. So I think that one also should be taken into consideration. I was happy when the gentleman who was presenting the recommendations to us made mention of the courts, that these cases need to be attended in private courts, but also in private places when it comes to the domestic violence issues. But to me, even when you go to report it, you should not be made to narrate your entire story in front of everybody else. There should be privacy, because this is a very sensitive matter. Thank you, Chair.
I'm sure you have picked that up, researchers. Honorable Moffat.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. I'm just looking at page 9, the costing of the DVA. The costing of the DVA. My concern there is what we've raised earlier. You know, we must be sure about who is the lead department, because who are we going to hold accountable for this costing? Because the researchers were very good, because when a person looks at the recommendations, there are specific departments next to it. But I'm just worried about the costing. Of course, we must hold whatever department, that's the lead department, accountable. But who is the lead department? Thank you.
A point that has been taken. Honorable Dorothy.
Thank you, Chairperson, and let me also thank the presenter. I want to agree that, you know, we fully agree and endorse the recommendations made here. There is something that I just wanted to clear. Oh, yeah. On page 13, under oversight, and then it's bullet number 1, 2, 3, 4, bullet number 5. Can I make to understand who is this interdepartmental committee, unless I didn't follow up, which has to account or... Is it a suggestion that we still have to come up with that interdepartmental committee?
that will still be, that might still be handled. We're just dealing with the legislative recommendations now.
I wonder what is this thing going on here. Did you hear the response, Dorothy? You did.
Thank you, Chair. Just with regard to the privacy of giving evidence and so on, I just want to mention one other point that I found has been really horrifying, is that when rape victims have to go to court, they actually have to sit next to the person who raped them. And I think this is really very unacceptable, that they should enter through the same door and leave, because I know in a case where I was involved, that this actually resulted in fisticuffs, because the family then tapped the other person. So we need to put in something about that as well, that the privacy of the people and their safety, because the trauma can just be relived every time you go to see that rape. Thank you.
Yeah, I think your suggestion is almost similar to what Honorable Pat has raised. Also, I don't know how we could include the part. Remember the little story I told you about where a minor has an affair with somebody older, and when they get to the police station, they are somehow convinced that they should not proceed with laying charges against the perpetrator. What is the role of the state there? Should there be nothing in the act that forces, you know, charges to go on? I just recently had a case with this, I think that the girl was about 13. I did everything, accompanied her, but when she gets to the police station, she didn't want to open the case. But I was concerned because she is a minor. I don't think she even knew what she was doing. So couldn't we have something like of that nature in the act as well?
Thanks, Chair. I think coupled with that, there was a concern during the hearing of elder women dropping off the charges. I think we should consolidate that, because I think the real issue is the dropping of the charges, because women go to the police station, lay charges, and later on they come and drop the charges, which I think is a big problem.
The problem is it's a waste of resources and waste of time. So I don't know how we could put some sort of an amendment in the act. But that is a problem. I mean, at the end, it makes a mockery of the whole thing.
In practice, in my personal experience, when I've had to deal with domestic violence cases, it's usually the discretion of the prosecution authority to withdraw the charge, and the magistrate in some circumstances can refuse to have the prosecution authority withdraw the charges as well. In such cases, the complainant just does not pitch up to testify when it comes to the trial stage, and then there are warrants of arrest and issued for, well, in very few cases, there are warrants of arrest and issued for the complainant to compel her to testify. But in situations where she is married to the respondent or to the defendant, she does not have to testify. So that's the gap that exists in terms of the applicants coming to court and then withdrawing the charges.
Honorable Slaw, we heard your hand up.
Yeah, I was saying I'm uncertain, but it looks like somewhere among the legislations we do have a statute that makes people under the age of 16, girls in particular, under the age of 16 to be regarded as minor, and that gets viewed as statutory rape. It's not a matter that this kid must go and open a case, but a parent can go and raise this matter and the state takes it over. Lay charges, the state on behalf of this minor lays charges of rape against the perpetrator. Well, but maybe that needs to be followed with justice.
But also to go back to Honorable Pep's suggestion that people need to be made aware of these things.
And there exists a section in the Sexual Offences and Related Matters Act which specifically says that girls and boys under the age of 16 where there has been sexual interaction with that person, with that child, that it is statutory rape. And then it's the onus of the parent or the caregiver to bring that specific case to the attention of the police officials and then the court. But once that matter does go to court, the state takes the onus of that specific charge and will then drive the process. So even if the complainant again does want to testify, they will still proceed with the matter.
Yeah, but then it should also go further than that as to what should actually happen to parents who don't do that willingly. Because you get such cases. When I eventually went to this woman, I asked her, but how are you allowing this? Such an elderly person having sex with this girl, I think she was about 14, 15. And she said, oh, what should I do? I mean, then there should be some, you know. Let's round up.
Thank you, Chair. I also want to take up our colleague, Patricia, when she said that we need to educate our people around their rights, but even more importantly, their responsibility. Because when we really look at the rights of people, they think that it is just about their rights, but they have a responsibility towards that right. And because what do our people do? They usually just blame government, or they blame the next door neighbor, or they blame everybody else, they blame the school, they blame everybody. So responsibility should also be added.
It's not a right that you can just enjoy. You also have a role to play. Now, can I just understand from the researchers, after this process now, what is supposed to happen? When do we put this in the ATC? And the after, what should happen?
Okay, what I'll go through now is all the recommendations around oversight. And I've subdivided the recommendations in oversight in terms of general and then per cluster per department. So once you've gone through everything, the committee will add in all the extra edits and comments. Like under the legislative amendment, one of the issues that was raised was to criminalize domestic violence. So that will add in. And then at the end, there are four outstanding matters which I'll raise, which we need commentary on. And once we amend the document, Nelisa will then send it forth to have it ATC'd. And then,
before it goes to the ATC, could we have copies after you have put in the recommendations?
Okay, so we'll amend, send the final version to Nelisa, which will be sent to members. We'll send it to the NGOs too, and then maybe if there are any additional comments by the time we ATC, members can indicate to us, but I'm sure we would have captured everything. And then post-ATC, there will also be a process where Nelisa could look at the debate in the House, and that's how that would be managed.
Sorry, Chair, on page 11, under 3.3.3, under monitoring, development of a performance monitoring framework for court.
bullet number three, doesn't this sound a little bit light? Can't we make it sound, you know, enforced, like making it mandatory that all domestic violence applications be dealt with in private offices where applicants confidentially may be maintained? Can't we use something that is like maybe compulsory? Instead of mandatory.
I think mandatory would capture that it is compulsory for those courts to hear those applications in private offices, but we could ensure, but I think mandatory would capture sufficient sort of.
Say that mandate means an instruction. You're giving an instruction. Thank you.
She's interpreting English to you.
Yes.
I hope you got it.
The good thing about it, which you might not have detected, is that this is 3.3.3. Bullet number three.
So now we are on page 13, looking at the recommendations that pertain to oversight. So under 3.2.1, these are general recommendations, so they kind of cut across most departments and other key stakeholders involved. So the first bullet point catches the issue of there need to be strategies to look at particularly vulnerable groups. And I will include pensioners, and I will include persons with disabilities. So over and above children and foreign nationals. In terms of the second bullet, there again, it's the National Youth Development Agency, the South African Human Rights Commission, it's the CGE, and what their role is in talking to their mandate in relation to domestic violence. They should be reporting and saying, given their mandate, what are they doing within a given per annum, what are they budgeted for, and how are they addressing this issue. In terms of the third bullet, that a mechanism should be devised in Parliament to ensure the implementation of the DVA by all committees. Yes, we acknowledge there are several departments involved, but also within Parliament in terms of how we conduct oversight. How are we going to ensure that the PC on Human Settlement, when Human Settlement comes, actually talks to the secondary housing needs? How do we ensure that social development, when they talk to their budget, actually talks to victim empowerment program? So a mechanism needs to be developed so that that's not lost. And that links to the fourth bullet point, which looks at progress with respect to the Domestic Violence Act, that Honourable Duncan suggested that we develop a scorecard. A scorecard to say, this is the DVA, this is what your program is, this is what your budget, these are the indicators within a given year, this is what we spent on what and why not. That's the department too. In terms of the next bullet point, the interdepartmental committee, that's at government cluster level. Justice had indicated to us and Department of Social Development that DGs come together to look at collective planning. But often we have individual departments that come to us that talk to issues. And the recommendations in the past have been, why not call that interdepartmental cluster committee? Because those are the key people within positions within the executive that lead around taking decisions around budgets and programs. So hold them to account, because they are talking cross-sectionally about issues that affect most of the departments. So it's holding that interdepartmental committee to account as opposed to only the DG within social development or only in-house. The next bullet point links to that Parliament insists on reports from the Department of Police in terms of compliance with the Domestic Violence and Firearm Control Act. Again, that's in relation to the implementation of these acts. The acts have passed. We had public hearings. But to what extent do other committees ensure that there's oversight around the implementation of these acts. And again, it goes back to where's the mechanism within Parliament to ensure that these things are consistently monitored and overseen. And then linked to the Firearm Control Act in terms of the last bullet on page 13, links to that Parliament requests reports on the implementation of measures to ensure that firearms are returned when staff go off duty. Because we've noted that there are security officers and police officers who are engaged in issues around domestic violence. So what mechanism is there within Parliament so that we can oversee that something's done, so when police officers go off duty, they're not going home with their firearms. Then as we go to page 14, the next bullet point is around the raising awareness that Parliament should oversee that the respective government departments actually have awareness programs around the domestic violence. So whether it's Department of Health, whether it's Department of Social Development, Police and Justice, and bearing in mind that each of these role players have a particular role to play in enforcing the Domestic Violence Act. But there should also be an overarching awareness raising about domestic violence. In terms of the second last bullet point, that in order for members to engage and oversee the implementation of the Act, there has been a request that members need training. You need to be able to go through the Act and say, well, what does this section mean? If I'm doing constituency work, how do I interpret this? If someone comes to me for advice, I need to know where I can get the Act, what this means, and how I give advice. So maybe a training session would be helpful with members to grapple with the Act. And then last but not least, in terms of the general recommendation, we noted that there's a lack of an overarching framework, something that says, how do we bring all these departments together to work together? It's something that's legislated for in the Act itself, but who will oversee that? If we look at our ministry, the new ministry that's been developed, and what their mandate is, they should be taking the lead role in developing such an overarching framework. And it's the committee's prerogative and mandate to hold them to account for ensuring that the policy is developed and that it is implemented with timeframes and budgeted accordingly. So the next section then looks specifically at particular issues, policing, that there needs to be norms and standards regarding training. Because again, we've seen, we were told training happens, but to what extent is training at the right level, pitched at the right person, that it's consistent across the country. The second bullet point, that the Department of Police must amend its national instructions to give clear guidelines to police officers as to when perpetrators should or shouldn't be arrested. And again, that's unclear. The third bullet point, that we can't be looking at domestic violence in isolation per annum. There needs to be a five-year plan. There needs to be an indication from the Department of Police. If we're looking at decreasing the incidence of domestic violence, what are you going to do across the next 5 years? You've been given a budget. How are you going to operationalize and use that budget? What's your thinking behind reducing the incidence of domestic violence? What should be your response? And that the role of the SAT in terms of the evaluation service, in terms of monitoring, needs to be related to targets. Because it seems as we're saying, okay, we're going to have a five-year plan, but we don't have any idea as to what the goal is and what your target is per annum. So in other words, we can hold them to account next year and say, well, if your target was by 2011 that we're going to reach X amount within this province per annum, did you reach it? If not, why not? Because then you can look at the budget in relation to the program, in relation to the target. The next bullet point is around the domestic violence registers. It's crucial. They need to be maintained. They need to be monitored. And we need to hold the person to account who's responsible for maintaining it and monitoring it. Because it seems that there is a domestic violence register with no information in, and no one's actually looking at the fact that there's no information in. So it's holding those people to account. In terms of withdrawals, that there needs to be a mechanism to deal with the fact that an incident was reported And as we've noted, that a withdrawal happens for a series of reasons. But that doesn't mean that the incident goes away. It had happened, there was a violation. So a mechanism needs to be developed to say, well, what's going to be the police's response in relation to that? And that over and above all of this, there has to be sufficient resources allocated. One, in terms of obtaining forensic evidence, because we have noted that even at the withdrawal also that happens at the judiciary stage, at the court level, that without sufficient evidence that documents where, how, when, evidence is crucial, but with that comes appropriate authority-trained personnel. As we move now on to page 15, we look at the judiciary. And here again, we've clustered the recommendations in terms of key issues. The first issue is developing a costed policy around family courts, that given that the status and future of family courts is unclear. We need to have clear policy in with this regard, and that maybe this policy should be elevated to the status of regulations. There has to be clear timeframes and goals in this regard. And in terms of the last bullet point, that the issue of specialized courts. Justice has said it's important, but to what extent is this important if we don't have any time frames as to how to ensure that special courts will be there, that they're going to be rolled out, and that this is monitored? In 2010, we have X amount. What across the 5 years are we going to see an increase in these number of specialized courts? Because with specialized courts comes specialized equipment, training, and specialized personnel. And I also like to bring to your attention that in the Children's Act, there are provisions around ensuring that courts are made child-friendly and that they are made friendly in terms of children with disabilities. That was costed for, the regulations that Justice has sent to social development, but it's holding the respective departments to account to ensure that this follows through. In terms of the next issue, developing norms and standards around training for court personnel, again, there has to be training standards and norms that should clearly stipulate what knowledge is required for the magistrate, for prosecutors, for clerks, and that there has to be a minimum level of competency in terms of looking at training required. And that the training should be ongoing with follow-up courses. That in the case of the Department of Justice, the training framework should be included in the revised regulations. So in other words, the strength of the training should be linked to the regulations. Because the sense is we request that, but it's not vested in something important as a regulation. And that the training should be assessed to determine how effective is this. Because we could be training loads and loads of policemen, but they're not implementing that. And why is that? In terms of accessibility, again, Justice should come up to us with what's the detailed plan to ensure that courts are accessible. And we're not just talking about a ramp at the front door and a ramp into the court room itself. One of the respondents at the public hearings emailed us in early December. She arrived an hour late at the court because she couldn't get in. She couldn't get in. She struggled to get someone to assist her to enter the court. By the time she got there, she had missed it. They refused to hear what her reason was. And at that stage, she emailed back and she says, Justice has failed me. It's the end of the 16 days of activism. I've been at the public hearings. I couldn't get into the court because of what was deemed as my problem. I have a disability. I'm in a wheelchair. I mean, that's how Justice has failed a person who had come to us and said to us what our the key concern is. So Justice clearly needs to give us a plan of, across the 5 years, how are you going to make courts accessible? In terms of the Sheriff's Office, again, we're requesting for a means test. Just like the means test around child support grant, care dependency grant, there needs to be a means test around protection orders. Because what happens if I come to the Sheriff, and I'm unemployed and I'm expected to pay 80 rand. I've only got 10 rand for taxi fee to go home. Where am I going to get the 80 rand to get the protection orders served? Next, we look at social services. In terms of the victim empowerment program, we've heard it's not doing what it's supposed to. It's not servicing the needs of the victims of domestic violence. So that program needs to be reviewed, both in terms of what the program has to offer and how it's being resourced. Second bullet is around secondary victimization. The Victims Charter nor the minimum standards defines secondary victimization. Why is that important? Because we know it happens. It happens within the Department of Health, where a nurse gives a person a very hard time because she's coming the third time beaten up by her partner. Secondary victimization. You hear that at police stations where the police officer says, you're 13, why are you outside so late at night? It's secondary victimization. If that's not defined, it's difficult for government officials to know when they haven't complied. So a definition is required.
The very one you mentioned now about the
So as we move to page 16, that we reassess funding criteria for the victim empowerment grants to civil society organizations. That grants should be made available to shelters, given that the fact that they have a critical service to play in terms of victims of domestic violence. At the moment, most of the funding doesn't go to shelters because it's not seen as part of a key issue that relates to victim empowerment. That in terms of victim empowerment legislation, there's something's been started, but this needs to be expedited. As somewhere quiet, we need to place pressure to say, how far is this, when will this be done, set time frames. Again, greater public awareness required around the rights of victims, and that you actually need resources to raise awareness. Besides pamphlets, and not just about T-shirts, but there needs to be dedicated means in which we engage with communities, be it around schools and children, be it around within communities for women who are at home, for persons with disabilities who are at home. So there are a range of issues around public awareness which requires resources to be able to do. And that then definitely needs to be greater synergy around the victim empowerment program, the victim's charter, minimum standards, uniform protocol on victim management. So what we can see is there are bits and pieces of legislation and bits and pieces of policy, but none of these things talk to each other. So there has to be, again, that mechanism that says how do these things relate. And that there's also no duplication of services and that people don't fall through the gaps. Lastly, in terms of lay counselors at Tutu Zreda centers, we've heard that this is problematic. Why? Because often the counselors are not adequately trained. Where they are trained, it's few and far in between. The management and supervision of these counselors is also problematic. And that maybe we should be rethinking around what the role of the counselor is. The recommendation that which had come from the hearings was that maybe the counselor shouldn't be called a counselor, but maybe they should be advocating for the rights of victims. Because it's unheard of to think that after a week of training, I can now counsel someone in depth around domestic violence. It takes a psychologist 7 years after internship, writing an exam, to be able to be given permission to register at a house professional counsel. So how can a lay counselor, after 7 days of training, sit with me after 7 years of abuse and counsel me? So maybe their role should be about advocating for the rights of victims. So walking through the system with them, saying, well, this is where you're going to get this application form, this is where you need to go next. So that would be their supportive role, understanding the system and working in. Leave the counseling to trained professionals who know what they do. Next is looking at the health services. And under the health services, I've grouped them under key issues. Psychosocial support. Clearly, we've got no idea as to what health is doing around psychosocial support. Yes, Department of Health came and said, we have these wonderful people who do these wonderful things. But the reality is, public hearings have shown that none of the health service providers actually picked up that many of the people who came to present already had a major depressive episode. They were depressed. Nobody picked up that assessment needs to be done in that regard. And that there needs to be holistic thinking around looking at reproductive health, HIV and AIDS counseling, VCT. So there needs to be a review of existing services. And as related to that, we need to have an audit from government as to, well, in order for us to deliver this program, do we have the required personnel? And where are these personnel allocated? and located at the moment, are they in the right place to be able to offer and render the service to victims of domestic violence? Clinics, 24-hour clinics are few and far in between. Occupational therapists, psychologists work set times, but domestic violence doesn't wait for working hours. It often happens after hours. So what happens then? And that as much as we look at the victims of domestic violence, we also really need to think about rehabilitation of perpetrators. And again, within Department of Health, they do rehabilitation. Where does the Department of Health fit in terms of offering rehabilitation to perpetrators? And that lastly, in terms of the 2-0 centres, that these should be opened up to victims of domestic violence and not only focus on rape survivors. Next, we look at effective information systems. And here, what we had noticed is that there is no systemized screening. In other words, I can go to Lavender Hill Clinic and report the incidents of being beaten. I then can go to another day hospital in the next ward a week later. And there's nowhere in between that the health system knows I've been abused several times, let alone within one health facility. So there needs to be a system that understands how victims often just don't present once to a facility but numerous times. And that should be a warning sign. And the same applies to children and persons with disabilities. As we move to the next page, again we're saying, so we're looking at there should be databases involved so that we can also monitor trends in terms of the incidents of domestic violence, and we can know the hotspots. Like we know the hotspots in relation to basic services, this lack of water and sanitation there, why shouldn't we be knowing the incidents of domestic violence in relation to our own constituencies and wards and districts? Lastly, in terms of the policy and strategies development, Department of Health doesn't have an overarching policy or framework that says how we're going to deal with domestic violence. If there isn't an overarching framework, how are they possibly going to be training their personnel to know this is what happens when a woman comes in and she's been beaten for the third time or for the first time, or a child or a person with disability? And that the training is important because there's a responsibility that the healthcare professional has to hold. Because if that thing goes, if that issue goes to court, there's medical legal evidence. But the health personnel need to be trained appropriately to understand that what they document is crucial. It's not just willy-nilly. It will help in the long term for that victim that has come forward. And that, lastly, in the context of HIV and AIDS, we can't separate domestic violence in relation to that. We need to say in terms of the ABC, how does the ABC talk in relation to a woman who's married, who's abused, who can't actually negotiate condom use? So what happens in relation, in the context of HIV and AIDS and prevention strategies and domestic violence? And then lastly, what we noted was an omission on our side was something specific around human settlement. That the recommendation should be that human settlement should come up with a policy that addresses the secondary housing needs of victims of domestic violence. I think they emailed us towards December and basically said shelters is dealt with by social development, and no, we don't have anything in relation to looking specifically at victims of domestic violence. So that's the recommendation there. And then just five outstanding issues as we conclude, which I haven't got on page 17, but I will talk to. One is all the individual follow-up that we've done. That's individual people who have come forward. We've noted their concerns, and Eliswa has referred the issues to respective departments. There's still some outstanding issues. And I think we just need some input from the committee as to where to be held into account. Would it be still through letters via an Eliswa, or would you want to call those respective departments in? The second issue is around choosing priorities. We've listed legislative amendments, regulations that we can suggest, and oversight issues. between the portfolio committee and the select committee, given your mandates. We can't do everything. We've got to choose. So if you choose, what would be that choice? And that would also help inform us in terms of shaping the program for the year. And the third issue is around anonymity of individuals who came to the public hearings. And I raise this issue because as Nelisa will publish her committee report, the suggestion was that we need to hear from members that we don't place the individual members' names in the report because of confidentiality and anonymity. That maybe we only take their first name or maybe suggestions in relation to that. The next issue is around conferral. So if we choose our priorities and we choose two, what do we confer on? Off the top of my head, I'm thinking of legislative amendments. Would we confer with the Portfolio Committee of Justice and the Select Committee to look at these legislative amendments? So what are the things that we'd work with other departments, other committees? And then related to that is, if we're not going to be working with other committees, what is it that we actually just send off to other committees? For example, the issue of housing. That maybe it's a letter from the respective chairs of the committee to say, we've noted in our public hearings that the secondary housing needs of victims of domestic violence have not been addressed and that we humbly request that this issue is taken up within the given year of 2010 and that we'd like continued input from the respective committee as to how this is dealt with. So that, in summary, is just some of the outstanding matters. Thank you.
So from the last one, I'm not sure how we would deal with that. It was just sending to the committee, other committees, will they respond or will they, I don't know, will they do justice to what you have sent? And also on the issues that you have raised with the departments from the individual victims, how do we hold those departments accountable? Must find a way of making a follow-up. I know time would not permit us, but I would have loved just to call them and say, look, you have been given this task, can you tell us what you have done? If time permits, we could do that, just to show that we are serious about this. Because I know some of these things, they are just taken and kept, you know, to collect dust. Is there any member that would want to say something after Kashifa's last
Thank you, Chair. Let me start with this one. I think also what will be important is for us to have a joint oversight visit, especially with the Department of Housing and other departments, so that because we should be oversighting of on the length. If the disabled people, they do have houses, women and so on. So I think a joint oversight visit is very important as well. But the thing that I wanted to raise is that, you know, the other day, I think 2 weeks ago, I watched a special assignment, and it was such a sad program, whereby in Khayelitsha, the lesbians are being raped on daily basis, and you know the case, there's one case of this young girl that is now on the third year or fourth year, she's been on I don't know for how many years, and there's nothing that is happening, and I think the act, the lesbians are not covered in this act.
I don't know how we could call them what groups, because the gays would be the same. I don't know how we could have one.
Same sex.
Let's put it that way, yeah. Okay. Honorable Robinson and then Honorable Tekke.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to endorse your suggestion that we call other departments to account, because I think there is a general impression that we're quite lightweight as a committee. Mm-hmm. And I think we want to show that we're not, that we're serious. We are dealing with major issues and that we can't just be fobbed off. So I reckon I support you 100% and I reckon that we should do this. This is a way of making our mark and showing that we matter.
And I mean, from the time you...
I don't know when you handed those to them. Was it last year? Mm-hmm. I mean, there should be some progress. These people have resources, all types of resources in their offices. They have staff, they have cars, they have petrol, you know. They are better resourced than us, so they should be seen as doing something.
Thanks, Chair. I think I've got 2 points. One, the issue of the individual cases or individual people who raised their concerns during the public hearings. I think we have to make them private. We should not publish those names of those people as outlined by our researcher for safety purposes. And two, I'm just surprised with the issue of the protection order. I thought previously that it's for free because most victims are those women from rural areas, those who are unemployed from squatter camps, yes, and those who are unemployed, those who are still dependent on their husbands. So I'm just surprised that and in most cases, these courts are very far away from their areas. So they have to look for the money for transport, firstly, to go to that court, and if they arrive there, they have to pay those protection orders. So I'm just surprised, how can we tackle this? If it's possible, let's amend this DVA. Thanks.
You see, this also goes to the unequal distribution of resources. Because why would you pay for that when we see municipal workers always up and down with cars roaming around? Because it's petrol that has been used in those cars. So it's a question of distribution of resources. It's not that the money is not there. The money is there. But how is it allocated? I think we have... Honorable Slawo, can you be the last one?
Please. Linked to this one of the protection order, I think, Chairperson, We have received lots and lots of problems that victims are going through. Problems relating to security, to psychological treatment, to economic issues, to education, health, housing, and to protection orders. And all of these, for any other person, even if not a victim, to access this is money. Now, whilst we are in the process of nation building and we are aware that we are in this committee that leads the vulnerable group, maybe we need to make an impact around the issues of access of these people to these particular issues without necessarily having first to look for money elsewhere. If you want to get a good psychologist to come and give you counseling at home, you must have a private one and you must have money to be able to access that. So is a doctor, so is food, so is shelter, so is everything. Everything, you must have money in order to get the best. And we are dealing here with the kinds of people who are disabled, who are unable to access employment to make those kinds of money to be able to do this thing. And that impact needs to be made one way or the other, where we can. The second issue, Chairperson, is the issue of the prioritization. You know, in the presentations, reference was made to things we can do in 2010 and things we can do beyond. And I'm just asking myself whether there is any plan in mind to handle 2010 potential violence of that nature, whether there is any kind of plan, or whether it's left to the committee to engage with other departments around the particular issues of what their plans are for 2010. And the last issue is the one of specialized courts. Just wanted to find out whether any research has been made in respect to what other countries are doing around this particular issue. I know sometimes it doesn't help much to look at other countries. Instead, other countries are looking at South Africa. Because you see, the impression that South Africa, it's a developing country, and therefore it's studying from developed countries. It's not true in all respects. If there are certain respects where other countries are studying from us, because we are one of those countries with the best constitution and the best kind of democracy, where other countries are copying from us.
Perhaps we could give a chance to that request on specialized courts. Then you, next meeting, you could have something on that. I'm not sure, Honorable Slow, the first point that you raised about the issue of dealing with these groups who have nothing, I'm not sure what could be done there. But I'm sure we could make sure that the grants that are available are accessible to them.
Mm-hmm.
For now, those are the only means that the foster care grants. Because lots of these people, they live with these kids, but they only access the normal grants. They don't access the foster care grant. Quite a number of them are still ignorant about the foster care grant. Slow.
Chairperson, it's just on the specialized courts, because justice told us that they're going to do away with it. So I think it will be something good if we can push, you know, specialized courts, that they remain as such. Because I was speaking about the rural areas, you know, where they don't have it at all. But then they have to look at, like we said, planning. I think one of the members spoke about planning, or plans to be put in place, that the rural areas can also access those specialized courts within the areas. Thank you.
I'm sure we will find some time. I'm not sure when is the budget vote of this committee. Do you know? We don't know yet. But I would love us to share. I know it's usually done in study groups, but nothing stops us to do it as a committee.
Mm-hmm.
That we share topics so that we do not all speak to one thing.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many issues that we can raise from the committee's perspective. We'll find time to do that. I don't know if you could check for us when is our project vote, so that we can set ourselves for the budget. We are now through with the report. Okay.
I'm going to be gentle and push a little bit more. Around priorities, we've gone through the recommendation, but we actually haven't said what is it that we can possibly do. So if we subdivide these things into three components, maybe around the legislative amendments, can we get guidance from the committee to say, is that something that the committee wants to do? As in, look at the Act and look at the amendments, because if that's the case, then Eliso needs to liaise with the PC on justice, because at the moment, justice takes the lead in that respect. Because if that needs to be done, then there's the whole process around putting that into the program and when that's going to be done. But that's if the committee wants to say, that's something we want to do. Next is the issue of the regulations. Again, to say, well, is that something the committee wants to do? In terms of the oversight, There's several things. Police, justice, ministry, victim empowerment, health, social development. Are we going to do all? Or are we going to say, well, maybe we take on issues pertaining to the ministry, that's obvious. We hold them to account for what we want. And maybe it's around housing and victim empowerment. Because if you look at our theme for this year, it's about the survival and development of children and women. That's what we're going to do. We can't do all. So I'm gently pushing and asking for guidance around what is the committee wanting to take on. So maybe let's start off with the legislative amendments and the regulations. If we can get, because that's part of, as we conclude this report, because once it's ATC'd, whoever reads it must be clear that the committee is going to be taking on this or has referred these things on. So maybe around the legislative amendments.
That's a difficult one. Very difficult. I was trying to actually avoid it. But I think with the issue of amendments, that one we must do, because that's what is hindering the progress of this act. But also for me, the issue of oversight is also important.
Yes.
I don't know how we are going to do it. Let's get the feelings of other members. Honorable Kiki? Mm-hmm. Can we move towards rounding off on the report?
Chairperson, I'm not sure when are we going to have this debate on the one on the public hearing, on the report. Because I think from now until when will be the budget vote. And I don't know whether before June we are able to have this debate or it will be in the second term. Because what I wanted to suggest, if we will, it was going to be soon, I was going to suggest that when we make that debate, we all make a recommendation that we need an amendment to the act. But I think we could do so even with the budget vote. Because it's going to show it is that one of the problems is that there is no proper budgeting for this. And that there is a need to, there is a problem, serious problem according to this report. And I think that we can take that chance. I don't know whether it's possible when you discuss your budget, but at the same time you make a proposal for an amendment to the Act. If it's so, I propose that when we debate the budget on this on women, we make that proposal. The second one was on what?
We, according to my knowledge, we have the power of two committees here, so I think it would be best if we then divide the competencies of both the portfolio committee and then the select committee. If you look at issues around justice, that's a national competency only. So then the portfolio committee can tackle issues around the Department of Justice and then look at that. Whereas the select committee then has competencies around community safety, around health, around those sort of issues. So then the select committee then can look at those issues and then we can cover more of the basis and not, so there can be more sort of impact on the oversight and on stuff like that.
Why are you choosing for us?
Just a recommendation.
Are you loving us?
Just on the debate, Jennifer.
Can we try and answer to what Kashifa's proposal was?
Chairperson, I was thinking, seeing that we're going to do our budget first, do this separately during that period too, because we can go in one day and decide, I'm sure we can make a decision, we are going to debate this report. And then after that debate, then we can all go again into the budget vote. I prefer that we should have two debates here, and I'm sure it's possible.
So you are saying something different to what Kiki is saying?
Yes.
I said, if it's possible, I'm not sure how long it's going to take. I know this process sometimes, we cannot have it. We cannot have it as soon as possible because I don't think we can tamper with this process of the budget vote. Yeah, so that's why I was proposing that if it's possible, when we debate, you know what, the recommendation that we should all make is to have an amendment to the act. That's what I was proposing. And then even during the debate, but maybe debate will have it in the next term, I'm not sure. Yeah.
No, she's right. It could take that, but we can't tamper with this process. Any other suggestions?
Let us check, because the way I see it, if we're going to have today the budget vote, can't we have this debate before the budget vote on the same day?
No. It doesn't even need a checking. We were quite clear that that can't happen. She was correct that you really can't tamper with this process of budget vote. Duncan?
Chairperson, can I please ask, I know that our ministry will only come into effect after the 31st of March. Am I right if I say so? Will the debate on the Domestic Violence Act, the public hearing, will that debate be before? Because should we speak? Okay, maybe they must just answer me first, and then I can...
Whether it's before or after, the issue is we cannot tamper with that process. That is the issue. Whether they come after or before, but the issue is we cannot tamper with that process that is on now in Parliament.
Yes, no, I understand that. I understand. I have a different reason
why I'm asking. But I understand the question. Again, a little there to check in terms of process and time.
Mm-hmm.
We have a program that has been set out with set times as to when there's going to be plenaries, when there's going to be debate. So I think process-wise, we still have to go back, request for time, and then and then there's a process. Chief Business has signed off, then it has to go to oversight, Mr. Bapele. Mr. Bapele will determine X, Y, and Z. So I think, yeah. We can only determine exactly when and how and where once Nelisa puts through the request and we've got to do the paper trail.
Okay, you'll check that for us then. Can we...
Yes, I just want to follow up on the answer. Is that should we not wait now for that we know exactly the date and all of that and come back on... what Kashifa is recommending us to decide on. Can't we then, when we have the date, just get together again, Chairperson, and then decide? Maybe it will be easier for us to do so.
Is that possible, Kashifa? Don't abuse this lenient chair.
Trying to find a way forward, Chair. Can I just say, I want to suggest that we accept all three because they're vital. We've got to go along all these routes. We can take that decision in principle with your guidance and if you are happy with that. And then the minute we've got the date and we've got a gap, then we go for it. Let's not wait. We've got to work in the meantime. We've got to equip ourselves and make things happen. And if they're there, they've got all these wonderful resources, they can help us.
I also wouldn't support the issue of waiting. But you will check that for us, Kashifa. What are the possibilities? We have gone through the report, discussed this, I think, very thoroughly. Can we then adopt it now? Could we have someone?
Okay.
A show of hands. Honorable Robinson. Can we have someone supporting? All of you. She wrote all of you then. Okay. So the report has been gone through, discussed. Recommendations made, though we will still await the bits and pieces that you are going to put in the report. Hopefully it won't need to go back to you again, I trust that. We will then go to the next item, which shouldn't take us very long. Let's try and push it very fast. That is the program, the first term program of the committee. Do we have copies of that in front of us?
Yes.
You do have it. Yes. Okay, you seem to be on your way up. Okay. Let's move a bit fast. Robinson, can you read the first part of the agenda of this program?
Right. Thank you. The first part is the briefing by the department. Well, we've already done that. Do we still have to read through what we've been through?
Mm-hmm.
Or I'll start at the beginning. Briefing by the Department of Women, Children and People with Disabilities on the annual report for financial year 2008-09. The second is consideration and adoption of the first term committee program, which is what we're doing now. Consideration and adoption of outstanding minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was the State of the Nation address. And then consideration and adoption of the draft report of the public hearings on the Domestic Violence Act. And consideration and adoption of the first term committee program. Then there will be the budget speech this afternoon, and from there we will move on to deliberations on the impact of the State of the Nation address on the work of the committee by the research unit, and the briefing by the Department of Women, Children and Persons with Disabilities on issues raised on the State of the Nation's address. That forms part of the scrutiny. Would you like me to continue?
Yes.
Briefing by National Youth Development Agency on issues raised on the State of the Nation's address. That will be on the 10th of the third month. That's part of the scrutiny. And then on the 17th, briefing by the Department of Women, Children and Persons with a Disability on strategic plans and budgets for the financial year. Also part of scrutiny. And then on the 24th, training on Domestic Violence Act and Children's Act to assist us to be more effective. And then a committee oversight visit on the 30th, from the 30th to the 1st.
How do we think the program is looking to us? Do we feel it's what we want? Do we should have any changes to it? Additions? Very briefly. Robinson?
Thank you, Chair. I'm happy that I think this covers all of it, but what we've just spoken about, talking on legislation and so on, actual action steps forward, I'm just wondering whether we can't work on that now already in this first term. Otherwise, we're going into constituency time and then into the second term. So I think we should get moving sooner, if it can be fitted in.
And you mean fitted in this program?
Within this program, yes. You know, the three suggestions that Kashifa made about looking at the legislation and so on. Because I just thought if we could be armed with information sooner, then we can act sooner when we get the gap in the program to have the debates and to make the recommendations.
Any other comments? Whip, any other comments?
Chairperson, the program of this nature is normally a working document. It's not static, and we should accept it as a working document, understanding that as developments unfold, we might have to add and subtract and so on in it.
Yeah, if
we think by the department on the
Can you repeat that, Kiki?
If
Chairperson, if you depend on the committee, it can be 2 days, you can make it 3 days, but then the 2nd of March, it's going to be a Good Friday, the 29th, the 29th of March, it's Monday, which is normally the constituency day. We can make it, we can start this program from the 29th. And then make it for 3 days. Or we can have it earlier before this week. But the date of having the oversight early is that there will be budget extended public committees, which is normally the debate process. And it's during that time, the House Chairperson normally doesn't allow committees to go on oversight.
When is Good Friday?
2nd of April.
Oh, okay.
So, sorry, the only option is for the committee maybe to start the oversight on Monday, which is the constituency of the constituency. Then, tonight, we finish our first.
And also, Let us briefly say, what are we oversighting? Where? For instance, for me, I would love to go to the police stations. Kiki had another suggestion of housing. I would also love us to go to the hospitals themselves, because after what I saw. So let's briefly say, what are we oversighting, and how are we going to split ourselves, and are we going to do this jointly with the Senate committee and all of that? Do we have resources?
Yes.
We do?
Yes.
A lot. Lots of that.
Yes.
Okay. Robinson?
Thank you, Chair. Just a question. Could we not do this earlier in the program? Because this actually falls within our constituency period. Is there no gap anywhere else that we could take off a day or two and go during the term time? So we're not waiting right until the end.
Thursday, Friday, and Thursday, Friday.
But we haven't answered, where are we going to? What are we oversighting? I said, what are we oversighting and where?
Okay.
Please come up with suggestions. Before I take you all to case that, and if you don't come up with
suggestions. Chair, I don't want to be talking all the time, but what I really think would make sense is that we see visit police stations and magistrates' courts. I don't mind where we go, but the problems are enormous wherever. But if you can see how the interaction is, then we can really get to grips with the DBA.
And also the issue of, we can't all go to one place so that we can cover. We will divide ourselves. Mm-hmm. We'll see how. But Robinson is raising the issue of magistrates' court and police station. Are we supporting that?
Yeah.
I think that is fine. So Nelissa, can you work something around that? In the area? What area?
The
worst. The
worst? Which province is the worst? Maybe it's important that we go in the
order. KZN is shocking. I don't know about other areas. But KZN is, but I'm sure they are all the same. Yeah. But I'm just saying what I've seen now during this short period. Like I've just given a case, how do you let go a criminal? Nelissa, also work something on around that. We will take what you have your suggestion.
Can't we just come to a conclusion and have one province? Because it won't be the first and the last. Let's agree on KZN.
Yeah. One province?
No, what I'm saying is...
We have said we are going to divide ourselves. Yeah, so we can't go to one province.
No, what I'm saying is we end up going where... Which province are we talking? KZN and the other two, or we make three. And divide ourselves into three.
That's what I said. Let's give that task to Nelissa to do.
Okay.
Can you do that for us and you'll tell us? Are we keeping the dates or are you going to try and fit it in earlier? I would also support fitting it earlier during Parliament time. Provide you make a request and hear what they say.
Yeah. As I said, it's going to be the budget vote debate after today, and the Senate public common house, which is the high possibility that the house chairperson will not allow us to go on our side. But I mean, if members feel that we can move it earlier on, I can make an application. It will depend on the approval of the house chairperson.
Do you make an application, hear what they say? If they turn us down, then we'll go back to your initial date. Members, can we pack? No. Let's adopt the minutes, and also let's adopt the program. The minutes are not here. What happened to that? You said we are going to adopt the minutes, where then? Okay.
Not for this week. Not for this week.
They were sent, but we are not adopting them now.
No.
Okay. So we are going to, let's adopt the program. Marcus moves for adoption. Can we have a second now? The T'Challa is seconding. Marcus!
I want to eat now. Chair, what I would like the committee to think on. We had a full program for the year, because it's part of the program. And what I would like to ask whether it is possible. That this program that we had for the year, could it be put into the ITC, you know, when we come to the end of the financial year? Because I feel that the committee did a lot of work, and it's important that we showcase what we did for the year. I'm not sure whether other committees do it, but I think it will be an excellent idea. Thank you.
There's a suggestion that we put the program onto the ATC.
But
just before you talk, but I need to put the, I know what you're saying, and I
But I'm just thinking, like Honorable Slawi has said, that the program can't be static.
Yeah.
What happens if it then changes? And it's already in the 80s.
I think I worded it incorrectly. When we come to the end of the financial year, look at the program, I think, went into the ITC already. And we have to account for what we did. Then we can put down the dates when we did whatever is written there with a short briefing on what we did. Yes, a short briefing of what we did. Thank you.
Let's get to the committee section. Does that happen?
No, Chair, not the program, but I think she says that the honorable
yeah,
yeah,
to the annual report.
Yeah.
To the annual report of the committee,
yes.
Not the program.
Yes.
Okay.
But you follow the program.
Of course, the
report will come out of the
program.
Okay, members, thank you. Can we part?
Thank you.
Have good lunch.
Thank you.
I enjoyed today's meeting. We want to see a lot of people.